The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight, we look back more than 30 years to the brutal murder of a disabled Jewish New Yorker at the hands of a Palestinian terrorist, an incident that shocked the world and continues to reverberate through the culture at large and through the lives of the families affected by the initial murder and the senseless reprisal. In an innocent bystander, the killing of Leon Klinghoffer, Julie Solomon offers a 360-degree view of the ruinous, never-ending cycle of the murder of innocents. Initially a longtime banking reporter and film critic for the Wall Street Journal, then a TV critic and art reporter at the New York Times, Ms. Solomon has written notable nonfiction books about show business, philanthropy, the Holocaust, the insanity defense, and modern medical care. Her 10 previous works include several bestsellers and two novels for children. It's a pleasure to have her return. Please welcome Julie Solomon to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for coming out on this hot summer night. You're not on vacation, but I'll try to make it seem like fun. I have a very brief film clip that I'm going to show you in a couple of minutes just to take you back to this moment in time in 1985, a time that we now think of as pre-terrorism, but anybody who has a long memory can remember that in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of plane hijackings and a lot of terrible things going on in the world as there are today. But Americans felt somewhat immune from it at that time. And in the summer of 1985, Leon and Marilyn Klinghoffer, a couple from New York, were about to embark on a trip that was really going to be a last hurrah. Leon had had a couple of strokes. He was in a wheelchair. Marilyn, his wife, was about to celebrate her 59th birthday, but she was in remission from cancer. And so with a group of their friends from the Jersey Shore, they booked tickets on a ship called the Achille Lauro, which Marilyn picked because it was what we would now call wheelchair accessible. They didn't use that term in those days, but she made sure that the doors were wide enough, there was an interior elevator that Leon could have a nice vacation. And they left on this trip on October 3rd, 1985. Thinking that it was going to be this great voyage with a group of their friends. And on the third day of the ship, four young Palestinians hijacked it. They had been passengers on the ship. The hijacking was actually not meant to take place the way that it did. And that was the story that I had heard at the time and the story that I knew. And it's a true story, but it's a much more complicated story, as most stories are when you start digging into them. 4 years ago, I went to an event at the Center for Jewish History in New York, presented by Ilse and Lisa Klinghoffer, who are the daughters of Leon and Marilyn Klinghoffer. And they had given their family archive to the Center for Jewish History. And I go to the same synagogue as they do. We weren't friends, but we were friendly acquaintances at the time. And so I went to this event, show of support. And it was riveting because the two sisters had been trained by a theater producer from the Moth Theater Company in New York. They told the stories almost like a piece of theater. The two sisters talking about what it was like to be here in New York, finding out about this event going on that eventually resulted in their father being killed and thrown overboard in his wheelchair. And they became the center of a huge international storm. Media, this was well before 9/11, so this was a rare event. And as they talked, they then invited onto the stage the reporter, Sarah Reimer, who had covered their family's story in the New York Times on the front page. And then they brought in this young, well, he had been a young man at the time, a naval pilot, Larry Neal, who had been one of these four pilots of these F-47 super jets that were stationed on a giant aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean, who was sent up to bring down the civilian airplane that was carrying the four hijackers from Egypt to safety in an Arab country. They forced it to land, probably illegally, in Italy so that the hijackers could be taken into custody. As he told, as I heard all of these stories, none of which I was very familiar with at that time, it was so exciting. I turned to my husband and I said, I think this could be my next book. And he had the same thought. And so I approached the Klinghoffer sisters sometime afterwards and asked them if they would participate in this and that it would be a deep dive into the story. And my thought at that time was to do a book called Klinghoffer's Daughters, which would focus on the Klinghoffer family and then what it meant to be a victim of terrorism, what it meant to survive that, and is there a way to turn that into something useful and good for society? It was going to be a more philosophical work. Shortly into the research, I discovered a part of the story I knew nothing about. 3 days after Leon Klinghoffer was killed on the Achille Lauro, in California, a Palestinian-American man named Alex Odeh, who was a peace advocate, he worked for an organization called the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, which modeled itself on the Jewish Anti-Defamation League, promoting the idea of positive presentations of Arabs in the media. At that time, there was Abscam. There were all the pictures of sheikhs buying up property in New York. There, it was well before, it was OPEC. It was all of those things. It was pre-Islamic fundamentalism, but these very negative portraits of Arabs, and this organization was started to counterbalance those negative portraits. He spent most of his time in synagogues and writing letters to the editor, trying to do reach across the aisle sort of negotiations. And when Leon Klinghoffer was killed, the local ABC affiliate in Los Angeles interviewed him for his comment, speaking on behalf of Palestinians. And he said words of condolence. He said that the terrorism was an outrage. This shouldn't have happened, and they asked him if he thought Yasser Arafat was responsible for it, and the prevailing wisdom at that moment in time was that Arafat had nothing to do with it. Arafat, at that time, was the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and in 1985 was the beginning of peace talks that would eventually lead to Oslo, and then the breakdown of Oslo. But Arafat was presenting himself to the world as a man of peace. The world didn't know at that time that he also had his alter organizations like the Palestinian Liberation Front doing dirty deeds around to keep up his status as a man of action as well. And so Alex Odeh said, no, Arafat is a man of peace. And in the interview that was aired on TV, the only piece that aired was the Arafat is a man of peace and not the condolences and not the condemnation of the hijacking. The next morning, Alex Odeh, who was in his 40s, he had three young children, all American citizens, went to his office, opened the front door, and a bomb went off, and he was killed. All of it, and the people who were believed to be responsible, the case is still a cold case, but the FBI investigating the case has always believed that the organization responsible for it was the Jewish Defense League, which was a far-right Jewish terrorist organization. So all of a sudden, we're talking domestic terrorism, we're talking international terrorism, and it's feeling like a very current story. So I thought, well, my scope is going to broaden. Then Googling around one day, I will tell you in my 30-page proposal, which Little Brown bought, called Klinghoffer's Daughter, I have about two paragraphs dedicated to the to the hijackers. I really didn't know too much about them. I knew there was this guy, Abu al-Abbas, who was the mastermind of the hijacking, and I figured I'd find out about them later, but I saw them as somewhat subsidiary characters, or caricatures, I might say. So one day I was just Googling around idly Abu al-Abbas. Up pops a book called The Curse of the Achille Lauro, written in 2016 by his second wife, Reem al-Nimr. So I order the book on Amazon. I read it. It's fascinating. It's a counter-narrative, this story, not justifying the Achille Lauro, not saying that this was a good thing to do, but explaining the politics and the history that led to it and what it was like to be married to this person in charge of it. So I thought, this is interesting. So I look up Reem al-Nimr on Facebook, 2019 report. Well, it was 2016, but reporting's gotten a lot easier than it used to be. It used to take years to track people down. Now you go on Facebook, she pops up. I send her a message on Messenger, thinking she'll never respond to me. However, she's a writer, I'm a writer. I knew that if I said, want to talk to you, she might. She got back to me and said she would talk to me. And we began a series of Skype interviews that went on for hours and hours and hours over a long period of time. So all of a sudden, now I have three families involved, three pieces of this story, and I was only beginning. But before I continue, I thought, just I have a very short little clip that we can show just to take you back into a sense of how this was reported in real time, 1985. Could we roll? I always want to say this. Could we roll the film clip? Thank you.
A rescue mission would be dangerous but possible. British commandos parachuted onto the Queen Elizabeth II in 1972 when there was a bomb scare in the middle of the Atlantic. Perhaps 12 Palestinian pirates seized the Achille Lauro.
From News Center 7, tonight's newsbreak is brought to you by Kroger. Good evening, I'm Jim Baldridge. French and Italian warships are reportedly shadowing that Italian cruise ship hijacked by Palestinian terrorists. 420 persons are aboard. One unconfirmed report says two Americans have been killed.
The murder of a 69-year-old disabled passenger from New York City angers America. After a 72-hour siege at sea, negotiations among the PLO, Italy, and Egypt succeed in getting the Achille Lauro back to Egypt. There, the four terrorists surrender the ship. At first, the world is led to believe that no one is harmed, so the Palestinians are promised safe passage out of Egypt. But the next day, the truth is learned, and the U.S. ambassador to Egypt makes the announcement. The murder of a 69-year-old disabled passenger from New York City angers America. Americans are outraged when the terrorists are allowed to escape on an Egyptian plane to safe territory in Tunisia. This time, Reagan takes action.
We pursue this. What we want is justice done.
In a flawless execution, U.S. Navy F-14 fighter jets intercept the Egyptian airliner in midair and force it to land at a U.S. base in Sicily.
These young Americans sent a message to terrorists everywhere. A message, you can run, but you can't hide.
Italian courts convict the Palestinian hijackers. But again, the Reagan administration and the public are left dismayed when Italian authorities grant freedom to Abu al-Abbas, the man believed to be the brains behind the hijacking. Italian courts had found no direct evidence of his involvement.
Responsibility for the hijacking of the Italian cruise ship, the Achille Lauro, but says evidence that his men killed wheelchair-bound Leon Klinghoffer was fabricated by the United States and Syria.
What is the use of killing an old man? Well, after all, he's old and will soon be dead anyway, without killing. I do not believe our comrades on the boat carried out any killing.
Abu Abbas was nearly captured when U.S. fighters forced an Egyptian air jetliner to land in Italy. It was carrying him and the four cruise ship hijackers. Over strong American protest, the Italian government permitted him to flee to Yugoslavia. Like so many battling in the Middle East, he does not see himself as a terrorist.
The Palestinian is accused everywhere, hunted everywhere, and is the terrorist everywhere. This is the picture the Americans have. In fact, the Palestinian is a homeless refugee without the right to a passport, without the right to visit his village or birthplace or even his father's grave. The Palestinian has lived in a state of subjugation and oppression for 40 years. Is he now the terrorist?
An act of terror right here at home in Orange County.
Yes, that is the corner office of what used to be the headquarters, as you mentioned, of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the 1900 block of 17th Street in Santa Ana, suite number 208. That is all that is left of that suite.
Today, the Santa Ana office of the committee was destroyed by a bomb. Audi was killed, and seven other people were injured.
And some fear international terrorism may be taking root here.
The man who was killed by that blast, Alex O'Day, age 41, married, the father of three young daughters. The bomb was powerful enough to shatter glass in several other offices.
Debris was everywhere. The wall was blown out. The windows were blown out. It looked like a combat zone.
Today, at Western Medical Center, where O'Day died, his brother Sammy told of numerous death threats received by his brother.
I don't have an idea who done it, but as I said in the past, he had received some threatening calls from people identifying themselves as JDL.
And as investigators search through the rubble for clues, a short distance away, a grieved family.
In a home where there is mourning, there are two sounds, the phone and crying. Alex O'Day's family is in mourning.
Alex left three daughters. Helena is seven, Samia is five, and Susan is just 3 and a half.
Sammy O'Day describes his brother as a peace-loving man who fled the Middle East for a better life in America. A fact, he says, that makes his death even more bitter.
In the one country where freedom of speech is very much sanctioned, it just doesn't make sense.
In the meantime, President Reagan has condemned the incident, calling it heinous, and has ordered federal bomb experts to assist in the investigation. The Militant Jewish Defense League has denied responsibility in the bombing, but its director, Irv Rubin, told CNN on two different occasions that he sheds no tears for O'Day.
So, as you can see, I ended up in the middle of a story that was far more complicated than I expected. And I hope you'll read the book, so I'm not going to go through the 400 pages of the book and tell you everything that's in it, but I will tell you a little bit about the journey to writing the book, because ultimately what I discovered were the stories of these three families, the Abbas family, the Odeff family, and certainly the Klinghoffer family, who were brought together by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, through whose lives you find out an awful lot about the history of that region, but also the common humanity in some ways that these families shared. And the reporting of this book was fascinating. It took me to many archives. The Reagan Archive has thousands of documents in California about the Achille Lauro. And one aspect of the story that I didn't expect to find were the sort of political machinations and how important the Achille Lauro became to Reagan politically, because he came into office in 1980 promising to end terrorism, because Jimmy Carter had the Iranian hostage situation, which lost the presidency for him in 1980. And then within the first 3 years of the Reagan presidency, we had the Marine bombing in Beirut, which had the biggest number of American casualties in a non-war since Vietnam. And this constant inability to keep up with terrorism. And you could see how the constant militancy on all sides sort of eventually led to 9/11 and what happened there. In the center of the story is Oliver North, who I found this incredible document. It was just when the Iran-Contra, if you remember that scandal that eventually enveloped the Reagan administration, Oliver North was just he was in a counterterrorism unit in the middle of the White House, and he wrote on a document to his boss, we have to make the Achille Lauro work because we have to divert attention from Iran-Contra. Never write things on documents that may become declassified one day, because there will be some snoopy reporter 30 years down the line who will find it. So I had many lines of stories going on. I had the family stories, the geopolitical story, and then the legal story. How do you deal legally with people accused of terrorism? And who has jurisdiction over them? An Italian ship, an American victim. And so the more reporting I did, the more material I started amassing. And the question was, how do you turn this into a story? How do you turn this into a book? Luckily, in terms of amassing the information, I interviewed 80 people for this story. A great number of people were still alive. So the ambassador who spoke there, Veliotes, about learning that Leon Klinghoffer had died caused a little bit of an international scandal himself. He's a very interesting man, married to a sort of rock and roll artist. Veliotes spoke to me, and at the time, the part of what he said, what didn't show on the video clip, he spoke on an unclassified radio broadcast, which you're not supposed to do, when he made his announcement. He says, some son of a bitch killed Leon Klinghoffer, and this went out into the Arab world, and it was not received very well. And so all these diplomatic gaffes, all these kinds of things that were usually kept sub rosa, became very public at this moment in time. And so the question for me became, how do you tell this story that involves three family tragedies, that involves an ongoing conflict to which there is no resolution, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and then the politics going on in the Reagan administration and the trial in Italy? And so my reporting took me to Israel, to Lebanon, to California, all over the United States, to all these different places, because there were many people and many players. And eventually I decided I wanted to focus on the three families, and the other material would weave into the story. But the actual construction of the book, which has been likened to a spy thriller, which it really felt like it when I was writing. I kept saying, what's going to happen next? And I already knew, but it was very exciting to put the pieces together. I spoke to Max Klinghoffer Dworen, who's the son of Ilsa Klinghoffer, one of the daughters of Leon. So this is a boy who had never met his grandfather. He died, was killed 4 years before Max was born. And I said to Max, what do you want to know about your grandfather? What do you know? And he said, you know, I know remarkably little. I know the outlines of the story. I know the boat was hijacked. I know he was killed. But I don't know much else. He says, what I want to know is the tick-tock. What happened minute by minute? What were the events that led to this? What happened? And what did it mean? And so I thought, when I was going through all of my notes, I thought, oh my God, you've given me the outline for how to write this book. And I really kept that in mind throughout the entire book. What is the tick-tock? And so the book really goes through this story in a kind of chronology, but it's also the kind of chronology we have in life. So the first half of the book goes very slowly, like life tends to do. So the first half of the book takes place in 2 weeks. The next quarter of the life, things start speeding up a little bit, so it takes place in a year. And the last quarter of the book zooms by, takes place in 20 years, because it's sort of the aftermath of all of this. And in the course of doing this, I spoke to both wives of Abu al-Abbas. His first wife was a Christian Palestinian. His second wife was from a Muslim, but a very secular Muslim family. His wives were both from very prominent families, very fascinating women, and he had five sons between the two blended families. I interviewed all the children, grandchildren of Leon Klinkhoffer and Alex Oda, and then all the ancillary players. And through these stories, I started to see the difference between the way history is presented to us in textbooks and in sometimes documentaries and certainly on the news, and the way history unfolds in real time for real people. And I hope that's one of the values of this book. Somebody had asked me at another talk I gave, what is the value of this narrative to people who weren't born yet, to people living today? And I have found I have children in their 20s, and they and their friends are reading this book, and it's been really gratifying to me how interesting they say they're finding it, and I didn't tell them to go buy it. My children had to read it, but their friends certainly didn't have to. And I think for them, the whole notion that, A, there was terrorism beforehand is just mind-blowing to them. They thought everything happened in 2001. But also, I think for a lot of them, it gave them a different perspective on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because what I try to show in there is not that, you know, this is not saying that the Palestinians were justified in hijacking this ship, and certainly not justified in murdering a man, and certainly not justified in murdering a man in a wheelchair, but to try to understand the historic causes that led to that moment, and then just to see all the different ways, because the behind-the-scene political machinations and the duplicity on all levels, you know, the Italian Prime Minister Craxi is both trying to appease Yasser Arafat because he doesn't want to have PLO activity in Italy, but he also has to appease the United States because we are the big gun in the region. And I had access to Craxi's right-hand man during this, Antonio Bedini, who was his chief diplomatic advisor throughout all of this. And Bedini and I spent many, many hours in conversation discussing this. And so you start to see the things that happen under the surface. And so I think for me, the story on the one hand was just a great story, and how these different families dealt with this. And subsequently, it's been unbelievable to me to see their reaction to the book, which they just read. The book just came out 3 or 4 weeks ago. And my biggest fear, quite honestly, was having Lisa and Ilse Klinkhoffer read the book, because they had been so open to me and so forthcoming. And then about literally at the beginning of the project, I told them, oh, well, it's no longer Klinghoffer's Daughters. It's now going to be a completely different book. Not completely different, but quite different. And they stuck with it. They kept meeting with me and talking with me. And not only that, but sharing the names of all the people who had accompanied their parents on the ship. Most of them are no longer alive, but their children are, to interview them. And yet I didn't want them to read the book till it was almost time for publication, because I've written many books, and when you're writing nonfiction, it's never good to have people who are in the book read the book too early, especially in these days of Facebook and Twitter, because if they don't like it or they're upset with something, it can go out into the universe before the book does. So finally, about 3 weeks before the book came out, I gave them a copy of the book to read, and their reaction has been unbelievable to me. How moved they were about all the things they didn't know about their parents. There was so much they didn't know about their parents' experience on the ship. I was able to reach the general who was in charge of the rescue mission, who was with Marilyn Klinkhoffer when she went to identify the hijackers in custody. And he recreated the conversation that they had as they went one by one to see these young men and identify them. And they were also, I think they were also fascinated and moved, really, to hear the stories of the Palestinians on all sides, and certainly the story of Alex Oda and his family. And they've been very supportive of the book, which has just been, a huge relief to me as a person, but also as an author. And then the next hurdle to clear was the Abbas family. And Reem hasn't read the book yet. She was traveling. I just got a note from her that she's just starting to read. But Omar Abbas, who was one of the sons of Abu al-Abbas, read the book. And he's gotten out of that line of the family's business. He does advertising in Dubai now. And he's a couple of years older than Max Klinghoffer Dworen, and I think they would probably like each other very much if they would meet each other. And Omar's reaction to the book was, he said, you haven't justified anything my father did. You haven't, you've been very respectful to the story, which is the story I've always read about, of the Klinghoffers. He said, but what I felt you did was tell the story with respect, that you're treating people as people. You're looking at a political leader who made a lot of really stupid choices, I think, in his life, but you're not condemning him. You're trying to understand where you're condemning the actions and you're condemning the strategy, but you're trying to understand where it came from. And so that also was very interesting, and I'm still waiting to hear from the Odeh family. I'm going to give away the ending of the book, but only because I think it's such a... I think it's such a beautiful image, and I think it's worth thinking about. So in Santa Ana, California, where Alex Odeh and his family lived, and where one of his daughter and his wife still live, and part of this is a story of resilience, of all these women who had to continue on. In one case, because of the thing their husband did, and the other two because of the death that their husband suffered. And their part of the story is something I'm really proud of, because it's the side of the story of the people who don't get written about, not the warriors, not the politicians, but the people who have to deal with the fallout of the stupidity of the politicians and the warriors. And this is the end of the book. I was talking to the daughter, and she was saying it was very hurtful to them that when Leon Klinghoffer was killed, President Reagan met with the Klinghoffer family in person and had a public announcement about them. And with their father, he said that this was an act of terrorism and it wasn't acceptable, but he never called them. He didn't send a note to them. They didn't get any kind of personal reach out from the White House, and they always wondered, well, was it because we're Palestinians? Why didn't we get that same kind of sympathy or empathy from the leader of our country? And they erected a huge statue of Alex Odeh in front of the library, appropriately enough, since we're speaking in a library tonight. And he was a scholar, he was a poet, and he was a teacher. That was his profession, in addition to the political activism he did. And the statue of him in front of the library was desecrated many times with graffiti, with insults on it. But a few years ago, they cleaned it up and rededicated it. And I tracked down the young man who was the sculptor of the statue. And he had been a student of Alex Odeh's. And when it was time to design the statue, he really wanted to do it as an act of friendship for this man who had been very important to him. And he said one of the things that he couldn't stop thinking about when he was designing the sculpture was a cartoon that ran shortly after Alex Odeh and Leon Klinghoffer's murders that ran in the Los Angeles Times. It was a cartoon by Paul Conrad, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist. And the cartoon, and I couldn't find it because he didn't remember what date it was, and it's hard to find cartoons online. Finally, I went into the archive of the Los Angeles Times, and I went through pages and pages of microfiche, meaning many, many advertisements for sales at Macy's or whatever. But finally, I found the cartoon, and it's a very simply drawn cartoon. It's a picture of Leon Klinghoffer in his wheelchair, and he seems to be in heaven because he's writing on clouds, and Alex Odette is pushing his wheelchair. And the caption is very simple. It just says, "Small world, wasn't it?" And to me, that was really, in a way, what this book ultimately is about. From all this hubbub, the murder, the international intrigue, the family stories, it's that it's ultimately a very small world. And yet, somehow we haven't quite figured it out, that maybe it would be easier not to be fighting so much about it. And so I'm on a clock. I asked for a watch. Thank you, Andy. So if you'd like, I'd love to hear your questions. If you don't, I can ask myself questions. I brought some just in case you don't have any.
How did the Palestinians choose Leon to toss him over? And I mean, you don't usually think of an old man in a wheelchair doing that. Was it to frighten everybody, to show how depraved they were, or something like that?
That is a great question, and it is probably the most unanswerable question, because just to give you a little brief background to answer that question. So the Achille Lauro, like any passenger ship, is huge. The four young men were not supposed to hijack it, because it's ludicrous, four people hijacking a giant ship. It's not like an airplane where it's a very finite body. This is huge. And what happened was, these four young guys, ages 17 to 23, got on the ship dressed as tourists. I had this great scene where they go shopping the day before the Achille Lauro so that they would look like tourists. It was a stupid plan. So they got sent to Italy for a few weeks beforehand to pick up Italian. None of them spoke Italian. It's an Italian ship. They had fake passports. The 17-year-old had a passport that said he was 35. And I think he was supposed to be from South America. One of them was supposed to be Norwegian. I mean, it was really, and security, needless to say, was lax, because they were allowed to bring their AK-47s in their suitcases on the ship. And their plan was, and to say plan, I should say plan, was the ship was going from Italy to Egypt, making two stops in Egypt, and its final destination was Ashdod, a port in Israel. And at that time, just to give you a little context, this is before the intifadas. This was when Israel seemed impregnable by the Palestinians. Nobody had ever invaded Israel. And this Abu al-Abbas became obsessed, and he came up with one cockamamie scheme after another. He sent boats up from the shore trying to, and they all ended up in disaster. With this one, the idea was that these four young guys would stay on the ship until they got to Ashdod, then they would get off in Ashdod and start shooting. And their idea was to murder a lot of Israelis. Not a noble plan, but in their minds, an act of war. They were never supposed to hijack the ship. What happened was, because they didn't speak Italian, the only one of them that spoke English was the youngest one, Bassam al-Ashkar. And so they get on the ship, and by the third day, they're getting more and more nervous, because somebody comes in to clean the cabins. They think it's a spy. They don't realize that these were young guys who had been brought up in a refugee camp. They'd never been on a cruise ship before. They didn't realize somebody comes in to clean the cabins. And they were getting more and more hysterical and more worked up that their mission wasn't going to work. And on the third day, the cleaning guy came in, and the zipper on one of their suitcases was jammed and the gun was sticking out. And they worked themselves up and decided that they had been caught, and they decided to hijack the ship. Now, most of the passengers were off the ship, because the ship had stopped in Alexandria, Egypt. Most of the passengers got off to go on a day trip to the pyramids. The only passengers, there were about 75 passengers left on the ship, and it was mostly people who were either sick or not feeling well. Leon was in the wheelchair. And so, but there were still quite, several hundred crew members. So it was ridiculous, but they decide to hijack the ship. And then once they do it, They try to land in Syria. They try to get passage to other ports. By then, the U.S. you know, the warning has gone out that the ship has been hijacked, and the U.S. sends out messages to all the ports, don't let the ship land there. Ironically, if the ship had been able to land in Syria and the hijackers had been allowed to get off the ship and go free, nobody would have been killed. So what happened was they have these passengers in this big dining room, which is where they're keeping them captive, and they go back and forth, you know, between being really nice. They serve them sandwiches. They bring drinks out for people, and then they get hysterical and start shooting at the ceiling. And they don't know what to do, and they're divided themselves. One of them is spending the whole time up in the captain's bow with the captain and to make sure that they don't try to any funny business, and he's the only one that speaks a little English. The captain speaks a little English, so they're kind of speaking English to each other. Two of them are down there with the passengers, and then Mulkey, who's the 23-year-old leader, is kind of running back and forth, and he's starting to panic. So by the second day of the hijacking, it looks like it's all going to be resolved, that they're going to get off in Syria, and then the U.S. says you can't land there, because they don't want to give haven, understandably, they don't want to give haven to the hijackers. And so now they're back at sea, and they're really, they don't know what to do. And they decide to separate the American passengers and the British. Most of the passengers were not American or British, so they decide to separate them as collaborators of Israel, and they were worried that a helicopter might land. There was a top deck, and so they make them go up onto this top deck, which was not for passengers. There was no guard railing. It was dangerous, and Leon couldn't go, because Leon could only go as far as the elevators went. To get to that top deck, you had to go up one of those narrow little ladder stairs. And so he was left behind. And all of a sudden, he doesn't have his support group. A few of his friends from the beach group and his wife went up on the top deck. And poor Leon is left down there. And then nobody exactly knows what happens. I have read pages and pages of interrogatories. These guys were interrogated by the FBI, by lawyers from the Department of Justice, by the Italians. And three of them had very consistent stories, the ones who weren't Mulkey. They were guarding the passengers. He was up there. They didn't know anybody had been killed. Mulkey, who killed Klinghoffer, kept changing his story. I killed him for the reason you said, to show that we were ruthless and would kill anybody. I killed him because he started hitting me with his cane. I killed him because whatever. I didn't kill him. There was no such person on this ship. And what happened was he took Leon Klinghoffer away from everybody else on a remote part of the ship. Remember, all the passengers or crew are being kept in this one central place. He takes him to this remote place, he shoots him. And then he can't throw him overboard because he's too heavy with the wheelchair. He goes back, he finds a waiter and a hairdresser who work for the shipping company. He makes them come with him. And they find this site, the murdered man in the chair, and then they have to throw him in his wheelchair overboard. But Mulkey tells them that if they tell anybody, they'll be killed too. And so then Abu Abbas shows up on the scene as the negotiator for Arafat. Now, nobody knows that Leon Klinghoffer has been killed except for Mulkey. The other hijackers don't know yet. And the two workers who threw the body overboard. And so Abu al-Abbas shows up in a little motorboat and as an emissary from Arafat, and they make a negotiation, and ultimately they agree that he'll take the four hijackers to port in Egypt, but only if no passengers have been harmed. And so there's all this discussion going on. They're trying to figure out. No, they decide nobody's been harmed. And the captain at that point does know, and he lies. Nobody's been harmed, because he wants those hijackers off the ship. And so when you ask why Leon Klinghoffer was killed, I would say he was killed because he was an American, he was killed because he was in a wheelchair, and he was killed because he was causing something to go off in this guy that was had really gone way beyond his skill level. And so that's what I really think happened.
What was the result of the trial in Italy for the other three? And what became also, what became of Abu Abbas? I kind of remember that the Israelis went after him and got him, but I may be wrong.
You're close, but you are wrong, but close. You're in the right ballpark. So the four hijackers went on trial in Italy. And that in and of itself is an amazing story, just to see how the U.S. brought them, they brought them down, and then the whole negotiation on whether they should stay in Italy or come here, and the lies and the manipulation that was going on was just pretty crazy. And how they let Abu al-Abbas slip out and get to Yugoslavia. I mean, a lot of this whole thing with the hijackers and Abu al-Abbas was a lot of hot potato going on. Nobody wanted them in their country because it was just going to cause trouble. And so everybody was trying to, like the Egyptians slipped them out of Egypt because they didn't want them there. And then the Italians let Abu al-Abbas get away because they didn't want him there. But the four hijackers underwent trial. And I was very lucky that I was able to interview both the defense attorney, who sadly just died a couple of weeks ago, but I was able to interview one of the defense attorneys and the prosecutor and read the volumes of documents that were filed with that case, voluminous documents, which were incredibly helpful and detailed. But the interesting thing in the trial was that the four hijackers all received lengthy jail sentences. Mulki was ultimately convicted of murder. The others were convicted of aiding and abetting, hijacking, and a bunch of different charges. What they were not convicted of was terrorism. And that is one of the most interesting parts of the court documents, because there's, in Italy, it's called, are you part of a banda di terrorism? I don't speak Italian, terrorism, so I'm mangling. But it's a specific charge, and there's a long philosophical discussion that the judge offers on whether they were a band of terrorists or just criminals. And Italy opted for criminal, because they said that they had a political movement that they believed in, and that they considered themselves a nation, and therefore they weren't terrorists. They weren't just randomly committing acts of terror. And it was a very interesting thing. They all ended up spending, three of them spent the maximum amount of time in prison. Actually, two of them spent the maximum amount of prison, and two of them ended up escaping, because Italy has a very different system of justice. After you're in jail for a few years, you're allowed to get furloughs. It's like you're in the army and you can go away for the weekend. And two of them went away and they didn't come back. And in fact, just a little side note, one of the most interesting people I interview, I shouldn't say most interesting, most surprising to me, because I've written books on a lot of subjects, but this is my first international terrorism book, so I did not expect to find myself interviewing Manzer al-Kassar, who was an international arms dealer who shows up in the middle of this story, and one of the guys who escaped ended up hanging out with Manzer for a few days, who sold the weapons for the Achille Lauro. Al-Kassar is now in jail in Illinois for selling arms to FARC in South America. And he also sold arms to Oliver North for Iran-Contra. So it's a small world. Oh, sorry, and Abu al-Abbas ended up living, he was evicted from Tunisia where he'd been living, and he and his family ended up moving to Iraq because Saddam Hussein at the time was very welcoming of the Palestinians, which was not the case in most of the neighboring Arab countries. Even today, I interviewed Bassam, the youngest terrorist or hijacker, and he still lives in a refugee camp in Lebanon, where even though he was born there, he's not a citizen. And so Abu al-Abbas ended up living in Iraq pretty nicely for many years. And then in 2003, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, even though Israel had given him amnesty and he'd actually been back to Gaza for a meeting of the PLO, because Israel, part of Oslo was to give amnesty to a lot of people who had committed crimes before X date. He was somehow on the card. Remember the terrorist cards that the Bush administration had? Abu al-Abbas was there. He got picked up by the Americans in 2003, and he ended up dying in an American jail at Camp Cropper, the notorious prison right outside of the Baghdad airport. I have his death report. It's about 60 pages long. I do think he had a heart attack. I don't think he was murdered, but who knows?
Did you talk to John Adams, and what do you think of the opera?
I did talk to John Adams and Peter Sellers. So the opera, so for those of you who don't know, there was an opera made out of the killing of Leon Klinghoffer in 1991. It was called The Death of Klinghoffer. And when it came out in 1991, it created a huge firestorm, as only opera can do. A lot of people were offended because the opera gave voice to the Palestinians, and it did contain a scene which was later taken out that was, today it seems kind of benign, but it was a little caricaturish and not that nice towards the suburban Jewish friends of the Klinghoffers. It's pretty trite. And after the showing at Brooklyn Academy of Music, they did take that scene out. I hadn't seen the opera in 1991. But in 2014, the opera was revived in New York at the Metropolitan Museum. And I became offended because there were many people protesting the opera in front of Lincoln Center who hadn't seen it. And I hate it when people protest things that they haven't seen. I think if they see it and they protest it, fair game. But to protest it before you've seen it, no good. And so at that time, I was kind of interested, and I actually went to see it. I'm not an opera expert by any stretch of the imagination. I found parts of it incredibly affecting. This scene that had been in the earlier version was no longer there. I thought some of the music was quite beautiful. Ultimately, the story seemed very melodramatic, but the two best arias went to Marilyn and to Leon. There's no question about it. There was no way you could walk out of that opera and feel sympathetic to the people who killed Leon Klinghoffer, but you might feel sympathetic to the Palestinian plight, which is a different story. And so at that time, I had actually thought of doing something on this story. Just the whole complexity of it seemed so interesting. So I did have a long discussion, and there's a chapter in the book, because it's in real time, that deals with the opera. You know, the thing with the opera that was so interesting, Lisa Klinghoffer, when she heard that they were making an opera out of this in 1991, she was so excited that Peter Sellers, who's this opera impresario, was going to be involved in this, that she tried to get in touch with him to talk to him about it. And she did get his number somehow in San Francisco, and they spoke. And he was pretty dismissive of her. Not really mean, just sort of saying, well, I don't really need to talk to you because this is a work of art. I think he made a mistake. He should have respected the sisters and I talked to him about that. And he did say he felt bad. I liked him a lot. I met him. He's a real character. I mean, he's in a he has his own worldview and different way of looking at things. But the opera itself, I think, has a lot of interesting music in it. Did you see it? Did you like it? Yeah, I think some of it's quite, I mean, you can't walk out of it and not feel quite moved by it, I think, in some ways. So thank you.
One of the things that didn't seem to come through in your narrative just now, I mean, I know this is kind of an odd question to ask, because ultimately at the core of the story, it's about the Palestinian and Israeli conflict. But one of the things I didn't hear was, as an event, it seems the Americans were the big reactors. Certainly, you mentioned Italy, the place of jurisdiction. What was the Israeli vibe on the whole incident?
You guys are so great. You're asking me exactly the right questions. So the Israeli vibe. So throughout the hijacking, the Israelis are always there. You know, the Israeli intelligence. For example, there's a moment when Mubarak in Egypt is lying out faith, right, just without shame to the Americans, saying, oh, the hijackers aren't here anymore. They already left, when they were actually right there, right outside of Cairo. And the Israelis had his office bugged. And so they were able to report to U.S. intelligence, well, actually, you know what, they're still there. And so the Israelis sort of, in the course of the hijacking, provided a lot of intelligence to the U.S. that the U.S. relied on quite heavily. Part of my research took me to Israel, and I met with Carmi Gilon, a former head of Shin Bet, who had the unfortunate responsibility being the head of Shin Bet when Rabin was assassinated. And I asked him about the Akele Loro, just to put it in the context of what did this mean to Israel. And he said, you know, he said it was a big deal for Americans. He said, because an American was killed. For us, he said, it was a few days of interest to us, but to us it was just one of many in a long line of incidents. And running through the book is this constant refrain of, you know, we're going to kill 10 of you, and the back and forth, the endless back and forth. And the other backdrop of the book is the other violence going on here in the U.S., that as the world is riveted and New York is riveted by the death of Leon Klinkhoffer, in New York City, 1,800 people are being killed a year because it was the middle of this terrible crime wave. And I said, so what about Abu al-Abbas? How did, you know, here he was regarded. He was on the front, you know, on the cover of Time and Newsweek, most notorious terrorist. I said, what was he? He goes, just another terrorist. And so I think for the Israelis, this was an incident that was an American story. They were involved in it very much so from an intelligence gathering situation, but they too did not want to get involved militarily at all. They said, you guys, this one's on you. And so that's another piece that was so interesting, was watching this intricate dance going on between all these people. Everybody's lying to everybody. Everybody is, you know, one thing I couldn't put in the book because I really couldn't nail it down, but I'm 99% sure it's true. One of the things that was going on when they were trying to reel in Abu al-Abbas and to figure out what to do and where the hijacker should go, and should it go to Italy or the U.S., and Reagan needed to talk directly to Craxi. Nobody could find Craxi. Where was Craxi? He was at his mistress's apartment, and so he wasn't taking phone calls. He didn't have a cell phone yet. That wouldn't happen for 20 years. So that was just a little thing, but I think with the Israelis, they're there in the background all the time, and the conflict is there in the background all the time. But for them, this was not a big thing. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.